seeks to do the will of God. And so this is how he is described there in Hebrews chapter 11. By faith, Abraham obeyed. And that phrase accurately describes Abraham in each of these instances. Now let's look at this promise again. I had laid before you the fact that there was the promise in chapter 3. It's one. The Bible refers to it as the promise and then sometimes as the promises. And it's a threefold promise, but they're all one promise. In other words, they're tied together. They're not independent of one another. And I believe that's a great mistake that people make, in particular to the land aspect of this promise. For some reason, because of premillennialism, want to exalt the land promise above the national promise or above the blessing, which is really the most important aspect of the promise. Because Peter tells us in Acts chapter 3 that the blessing that is comprehended in the Abrahamic promise is the turning of every one of you away from his iniquities. The promise is the remission of sins. The promise is the Messiah who's going to die for the world and be the propitiation for the sins of mankind. There is no hope for mankind that's not contained in that promise. But the land promise and the nation promise were essential to that last promise of bringing Christ. There's not just a blessing, there's a person who is the center of that blessing. In other words, there is no blessing of the forgiveness of sins without the Messiah. And so in Genesis 3, it was the seed of woman. And now in Genesis 12 and following, we're going to identify it as the seed of Abraham. And there's some play on that that we need to talk about. But in Isaac, will your seed be called, is the promise in chapter 21. And this is the great focus of the blessing. But we talked about the land, and we defined the land as being the land of Canaan, the land of the nine nations that are mentioned in chapter 15, ultimately pared down to seven nations when they come out of the land of Egypt, and they're listed in Exodus. Either some of those people were ceased to exist, they were destroyed, or they were absorbed, or they're identified by a larger name, because like sometimes the word Canaanite describes all of them. Sometimes the word Amorite describes them. Then the words Amalekite get involved in that with some of the residents or inhabitants of the land of Canaan. So there are a lot of different terms, but we know what the territory is, and it's specifically described as extending from the river of Egypt to the river, or the river Euphrates. Now, the river of Egypt is not the Nile. The river of Egypt is the Wadi El Arish. It's that large inland wadi there at the southwestern edge of Palestine, usually on the maps, right there, just between Palestine or Canaan and Sinai Peninsula. That region is generally referred to as the Negev or the South. And this is where we find Abraham oftentimes. He's not at Hebron or Mamre, which is Hebron. He's down at Beersheba, which is in the South. And this is where he was when he separated from Lot. Lot went eastward towards Sodom. My personal conviction is that Sodom, there were five cities of the plain, Sodom, Gomorrah, and three other lesser cities. And these five cities, with the exception of that least one, were destroyed in the destruction of the plain. And Lot had prayed for that last one so he would have a place to flee, and then they ran him out of there. But the point being is that that area was destroyed, and I personally believe that the Salt Sea is the result of that. There's some debate about that, but that's my personal conviction, that because those cities are not to be found. They were utterly destroyed, and that region is nothing but pits and salt and not much else. But be that as it may, we know that that region experienced a great catastrophe as a result of the sins of Sodom and Gomorrah. But anyway, the land that Abraham obtained by promise, it would be to the west and to the north of that region. So standing in Beersheba, north, south, east, and west, or Mamre, north, south, east, and west. Now, let's talk about the fulfillment of this. We're getting out of our immediate context of our study. In other words, we've got to go forward in the history of Israel to see this all the way up to the period of the conquest. And then later we'll look at a passage that pertains to Solomon during the days of the United Kingdom. But in Joshua chapter 21, and this would be after the children of Israel have come into the land. Joshua is 110 years old nearly. And so this would be, he was 40 years when he came out. He was 40 years in the wilderness. So he's 80. So it's been 30 years since they entered into the land at the age of 110. And so there in Joshua chapter 21 and verse 43, the statement is made that the Lord gave unto Israel all the land which he sware to give unto their fathers, and they possessed it and dwelt therein. And the Lord gave them rest round about according to all that he sware unto their fathers. And there stood not a man of all their enemies before them. The Lord delivered all their enemies into their hand, and they failed not aught of any good thing that the Lord had spoken unto the house of Israel. And Joshua reiterates that in chapter 23 and verse 5, when he says, the Lord your God, he shall expel them from before you and drive them from out of your sight, and ye shall possess their land as the Lord your God hath promised unto you. Now, some have argued, well, the Jews never did possess the land because they were still, even after the children of Ephraim and Manasseh, Gad and Manasseh came back across the river, and Ephraim and the half-tribe of Manasseh stayed on the other side. And the story there in chapter 21 is the building of the altar, which was a memorial altar, not a sacrificial altar. And the name of it is Ed. Ed Dye used to preach a sermon called The Story of Ed, but which I always thought was kind of humorous. But it was called Ed, which means witness, and the whole thing is about the relationship between the two sides, the tribes on either side of the river, and their faithfulness to God. But the reality is the book of Joshua closes with their having completed the conquest, even though there were still people in the land. But God said he would leave people in the land. He wouldn't drive them all out at once. Why? Because he didn't want the land to be empty. So the Jews, or the Israelites, were not sufficient in number, even though they were a mighty multitude, 600,000 plus fighting men that came into the land, right? So they were a multitude, but still, God did not want to just completely vacate the land. So they drove them out bit by bit, possessed it, built it, came back and settled on the other side of the river and continued to drive out the people. But because of their lack of faithfulness, they didn't drive them all out, did they? So that gets into part of this problem that the premillennialist thinks exists. But the passage says in chapter 21 that God gave them the land. Now, back up to chapter 6 of Joshua, just as a parallel example or a smaller scale. All right, notice there, now let's go back actually to, I think it's right there in chapter 2, he sent out two men to spy out the land. They came to Rahab the harlot and so on and so forth. And then verse 2 of chapter 6, the Lord said unto Joshua, see, I have given into your hand Jericho and the king thereof and the mighty men of valor. In chapter 6, did the children of Israel possess Jericho? No, they're still over here on the other side of the river. So they're going to cross the river, go around, and they're going to march one time every day for 6 days and then 7 times on the 7th day. And then they're going to blow the ram's horns. And then the walls are going to fall down and they're going to go straight up into the city and take it. But in chapter, that's after this statement though, you see. So God says, I have given it to you. But what did they have to do? They had to go possess it. And that's true of the entire land. God says, I have given it to you, and there's not one thing that's failed. So if the children of Israel had gone to possess the land like they were supposed to, what would have happened? God would have given it to them. They would have actually possessed all of it. He said, I will send the hornet before you. You're not even going to have to take up arms against these people. I'm going to drive them out of the land. But I'm not going to do it without your participation. I'm not going to do it without your active involvement as an exercise of your faith. So this is why in Hebrews chapter 11, the walls of Jericho falling are in this list of examples of things that happened by faith. Right? But God says, I've given it to you. So there was a promise, and God says that promise is not going to fail. And so here's what we need to begin to see about the Abrahamic promise. Turn back now to the book of Genesis. To chapter 15. So God said, I've given it to you. They had it. And in the days of Solomon, that's 1 Kings 4, Solomon reigned from the Wadi El Arish all the way to the river Euphrates. There are even times when the borders of the children of Israel extended beyond those that God had promised. They didn't keep those permanently. But they got everything God said they would receive and fully possessed it and reigned over it in the days of Solomon. 1 Kings chapter 4, verse 21, verse 24. Now in Genesis chapter 15, you have another instance in which God appears to Abraham. There in chapter 12 or 11 is mentioned because that's what Acts chapter 7 says. Then in chapter 12, there's 2 times mentioned. Then after chapter 13, in chapter 13, after the separation from Lot, there's a time mentioned. And then we get to chapter 15 of Genesis, and Abraham is standing before God, and he's praying about this promise that God has given to him, saying, this Syrian of Damascus, Eliezer, this servant who was born in my house, he's my steward, and that's the only heir I have. And God said, he shall not be the heir, but one of your own loins will be the heir. Then he takes him out, and he says, look at the stars of heaven. He says, if you can number them or tell them, if you can number them, he says, that's how many your descendants will be. Well, you know that the stars are innumerable. And so then he says, how shall I know that I will inherit it? Not that he was doubting what God is saying, because the text says Abraham believed God and it was reckoned unto him for or unto righteousness. So it wasn't, he says, how shall I know? Just like with Hezekiah, God said, ask a sign. And so he says, how shall I know? And so he gives him a prophecy that his people, his descendants, would be taken or would go to a foreign land which is not their own. What land was their own? Canaan. See, they'll be taken to a land which is not their own, and they will be ill-treated, and that all of this will take a period of about 400 years. And then they will come out in the 4th generation. It says, Abraham, here's the thing about it, though. You're going to die in a good old age before any of this takes place. And we know that Abraham died at 175 years old. And he didn't see any of it take place. Question. Did Abraham receive the land? What? Just venture a guess. I don't, yes, okay. But did he actually possess the land?
No.
See, because God's plan was, but he says, unto you and your seed I will give it. So God gave it to Abraham, but Abraham never owned one square centimeter of Palestine as a result of God's gift. The only thing that Abraham ever had in Canaan that was his was the cave of Machpelah, or Machpelah. That's how I learned to say it when I was a kid, Machpelah. The cave of Machpelah, where he buried Sarah, and then Jacob buried Leah and himself, and then Isaac buried Rachel. I skipped one. Isaac buried Rebekah. All right, so the three of them were buried there, and their wives. That's all he ever owned for 400 shekels. And he had to buy that to get it. So that's why Hebrews 11 says that they, turn over there, keep your marker at Genesis 15. But Hebrews 11 says, verse 13, these all died in faith, not having received the promises, but having seen them afar off, and were persuaded of them, and embraced them, and confessed that they were strangers and pilgrims on the earth. So Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob never received the promises, actually took possession of the land. But what did they do? They were fully persuaded. Now that's faith. They were trusting in those promises. And that's the point. And that's how men like Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and others are justified by faith on that side of the cross. Because they're trusting in the promise. The promise hasn't been fulfilled completely, but they're trusting in the promise. The land, the nation, both of which are necessary to the seed, which ultimately is Messiah. Okay? So Abraham never saw, he saw the land, but he didn't own the land. Abraham never saw the nation because there was him and Sarah and Isaac. And Isaac just had two boys, Jacob and Esau, at the time of his death. And then Jacob went into Padan Aram, and there he had 13 children, of which Joseph was one, and Levi was one. And Dinah was one, and Dinah didn't get a possession in the land. Levi didn't have a territorial possession. And Joseph got two possessions, Ephraim and Manasseh, whom Jacob took as his own sons in Israel. And so there's the 12 tribes. So the names of the 12 tribes are not the names of the 13 children or the 12 sons. Abraham, Isaac, and the promise. Now, going back to chapter 15. So after God told him that he was going to do this, he said, how shall I know? And he gave him the sign. And then he said, get a calf and a ram and two turtle doves. And so he prepared them for a sacrifice, and he split the calf and he split the ram, and he laid laid them on their sides, and then the two turtle doves on either side. And then he spent the rest of the day driving the birds off. You remember, keeping the carrion eaters off of the sacrifices. And then a vision came upon him, and he saw the smoking lantern passing between the pieces. And this was God passing through the pieces. Now, the book of Jeremiah, and you can look this up, is the only other reference I know of passing through the pieces. And Jeremiah says, that's your homework assignment, that's why I'm not telling you what it is. Jeremiah says that God was going to punish Israel because the men had passed through the pieces, but they hadn't kept their covenant. So the significance, it seems to me, of the passing through the pieces is when the smoking lantern, which is Jehovah, passed through the pieces, God was binding on himself the promise. And so the land promise is a unilateral promise. I mean, Abraham didn't have to do anything in order to fulfill the promise. Abraham just had to believe in the promise. Now, I'm not saying that Abraham didn't have to do anything, okay? Don't misunderstand me. We're talking about a unilateral covenant or unilateral contract. There's two kinds of contracts, bilateral, unilateral. I deal with bilateral contracts every day. You give me earnest money, and I take the piece of land off of the market, and we agree to a closing date and a sales price at a certain time. All right? So that's a bylaw. I have to do something. You have to do something. There's consideration given, and then there's the exchange of funds and the release of title and the defense and the promise to defend title, and hence the deed of trust and the warranty deed. And so this is how we do it in Texas. So that's a bilateral agreement. But then there's a unilateral agreement where I just promise to do something, and that's the kind of promise you make your kids. I'm going to take you to the park for your birthday. They don't have to do anything. Now, if you put an if on there, it becomes a bilateral contract. I'll take you to the park if you clean up your room. That's a bilateral contract. But a unilateral contract, I promise to take you to the park on your birthday. Okay. I'm the only one who has to do anything. And my word is supposed to be good. And so God, he passed through the pieces in this vision. Now later at Mount Moriah, the oath which God swore to Abraham is recorded. And that's what Hebrews 6 is referring to, that God, by two immutable things, the fact that he made the promise and the fact that he swore by himself, that guaranteed the promise. But that's not the same thing as Genesis 15, which was a vision to Abraham. And it's not fully explained in the context. The only other passage that I think has anything to do with it is Galatians chapter 3, verses 19 and 20, when Paul's talking about the purpose of the law. And he says, the law, he says, what then serveth the law? It was added because of transgressions till the seed should come to whom the promise was made. It was added, or it came in alongside, till the seed should come who to whom the promise was made, and it was ordained by angels in the hand of a mediator. The law was ordained but in the hands of a mediator. Why? Because there was God on one side and there was Israel on the other side, and Moses was the mediator. And God said, do this. And the children of Israel said, we will do this. All right. So God said, do this and I will bless you. And the children of Israel said, we will do this. And so they entered into a contract, and Moses was the mediator. All right. Now, a mediator is not a mediator of one. You don't need a mediator in a unilateral contract. Why? Because I'm the one who's supposed to do it. I know what I said and I'm supposed to do it. So it's, you know, you don't need a mediator. You don't need someone to come and mediate on behalf of the mediator, on the behalf of the one who made the promise, you see. So there's no mediator. It's just, I promise to do it and either I do or I don't. But God is one. Is the law then against the promises of God? You see, that's where that's going. And so he's talking about the law in comparison to the promises. And the law came in beside. The law was not the promise. Justification is not by the law. Justification is through the promise. And so what I'm trying to get you to see is that God promised to save mankind. And remember, that's what we've been talking about in some of our lessons about on Sunday night when we were talking about that phrase, before the foundation of the world, right? God's eternal purpose was to save mankind. God's plan was to send Jesus into the world. That before he ever said, let there be light, all right? And then God revealed that plan or purpose or aim, which Paul calls in Ephesians 3 his eternal purpose in Christ Jesus. So God reveals that in to Abraham, and that becomes the promise, and this is what God is going to do. Now, that's not to say men don't have to obey God. That's not to say men don't have to trust in the promise. But where the distinction there is the grounds of the promise and the means of the promise as opposed to the conditions of the promise. You see, people look at Genesis 15 and they say, well, that's the promise of salvation. That's unconditional. That's right. The promise of salvation is unconditional in the sense that God said he would do it. There's not anything you can or have to do in order to get God to send Jesus into the world. See, that's the point I'm trying to make. It's an unconditional promise on the part of God to do it. And the law, which was 430 years after, you see, Paul says in Galatians 3, the law of 430 years after doesn't change that, because it's, even if it were a man's covenant, what does Paul say in Galatians 3? If you and I have a contract, Randall, and we've signed it and it's been ratified and so on and so forth, you've given your consideration, I've given my consideration and so on and so forth, and we have an executed contract, can we change it? No. We can mutually agree to tear it up, but you can't change the terms of the contract, and I can't change the terms of the contract. We can negotiate something else, but as far as the contract is concerned, even though it's a man's contract, you don't go around changing contracts. If contracts have no permanence, this is why the biggest part of American law is contract law. It's not criminal law. It's contract law. The sanctity of a contract. And so, and one of the things that we have in the United States, which is different than a lot of places in the world, is that that contract is good in Texas, it's good in Louisiana, it's good in Arkansas, it's good wherever it goes. That's one of the terms or one of the conditions of being one of the 50 states, is the recognition of contracts. So that's why when Randall and Joy got married over here in Louisiana and they go over to Texas once in a while for a vacation, guess what? They're still married. Why? Because Texas recognizes that contract. And so that's why sometimes young people would go to another state where the marriage age was younger, because when they came back, they were married. See? They're married. And so that's the idea. So even though it be a man's contract, you're not going to change it. So it's a contract that God bound upon himself, and the law doesn't change it. Just because God gave the law at Mount Sinai does not mean that he was changing the terms of the contract or he was giving another system of justification. It came in besides because of transgression. It was an aid. It was a limited relationship with the children of Israel, but it was never intended to supersede or to replace or to modify, whatever word you want to use here, the promise. Because what's the promise? The promise is justification by faith in Jesus Christ. All right, now, so people say, well, the Jews are supposed to keep the land forever. No. Well, you said last week that the promise was forever. Yes, that's right, that word, olam, time out of mind. Pastor Presence, used there in Genesis 13 and verse 14 and chapter 17 and verse 8. Of the land promise. And that's what they read. Forever. Well, if it was forever, and it was given to Abraham, and yet the Bible says he didn't receive the promises, what does that necessarily imply? There were conditions. God said, I'm going to do it. You're going to be the beneficiary of it. Your descendants are going to be the means by which I accomplish it. But it's conditional. See? So let's look at a few passages on that. Look at Genesis 15 and verse 5. And he brought him forth abroad and said, now look toward heaven and tell the stars if thou shalt be able to number them. And he said, so shall thy seed be. All right? So there's some, it involves his descendants, doesn't it? The promise of the land was conditioned also on the existence of a nation. And so shall thy seed be, and I will give it to them, and I will bring them out in the fourth generation. That's all of what chapter 15 is about. So there are conditions being explained. But God says, I'm going to do it. Coming on to chapter 18 and verse 18. Seeing that Abraham shall surely become a great and mighty nation, and all nations of the earth shall be blessed in him. It's something yet in the future. So when God made that promise to Abraham, it was understood in the context of the promise, there were certain things that had to happen in order for it to occur. Now, no one is saying, at least no doctrine that I know of is saying, well, God didn't give Abraham the land. But what I'm saying is, well, when you say that God either didn't give Israel the land or God took the land away from Israel, you've got to recognize it was conditional in the first place. God says, I'm going to do it, and I gave it to you. Now, whether or not you possessed it, whether or not you kept it, Ricky came up to me last week and said, you know, I've told many a guy, I'll give you a job, but it's up to you to keep it. See, there's conditions that are associated with that. I'm going to give you the job. It's mine to give. But you've got to keep it. And that's the relationship with Israel. I'm going to give you the land. And as long as you do everything I tell you to do in relation to that, you can keep the land. The nation Israel could be in the land today if they had obeyed God. But God knew they weren't going to obey. God showed that they weren't going to obey. And even through Daniel prophesied how it would that they would lose the land in the destruction of Jerusalem in 70 AD. Well, let's go a little further. Chapter 22, verse 17. That in blessing I will bless thee, and in multiplying I will multiply thy seed as the stars of heaven and as the sand which is upon the seashore, and thy seed shall possess the gate of his enemies. Well, we've already read that over in Joshua, that they had to go into the land and possess it. Let's just stop right there. We've seen that the land was given, they received it, and they could retain it conditionally. Now, next time we'll talk about the problem of the fact that they were removed from the land before Jesus came. That's the real problem for the Jews, and we'll look at a passage in Psalm 89 about that. You might read that ahead. And we'll talk about that reality with respect to this.